Happy New Year with many blessings of health and wellness to all listeners. We're starting a new season with a new theme, expanding the breath, breathing restorative justice into family, society, and workplaces. We will be expanding the ideas and concepts of restorative justice, asking critical questions and peeling back layers of comfort to delve into deeper transformative practice. Please join us this season to expand what you know about RJ. So I'm going to pass the mic to Maida.
Hi, Gilbert. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I am a big time fan of What You Know About RJ. Been listening since it was first put out there. So just really appreciating this work that you have been doing along with like the folks that, you know, came before in the Restorative Justice in Schools team. So very grateful to be here and very grateful for your invitation to partake in these conversations. My name is Mayra Angelica Serna Arámbula. My role at CCEJ is I'm a training specialist for the Iluminar department. And things that I want to claim in terms of my identity and who I am and what I bring is I am guided by ancestors in a lineage of Mexicanos coming from Aguascalientes, Mexico. My parents are immigrants to this country here in the U.S. And another thing I want to claim, of course, is the Santana, which is a community where I am from, community where I was born and raised, a community of very rich history, of a predominantly Latinx working class community where I grew up and where I, you know, acquired a lot of my values, a lot of my guides, and really what I carry into this world and what I carry into this work.
And for folks who don't know, Santana is the city of Santana or Santa Ana in Orange County, where Maida and I were both born. All right, folks, so today Maida and I are going to be having a conversation that's centered around with stories and skills around being trauma-informed, while also acknowledging the historically rooted harm of institutions, historical context of colonialization, capitalism, and patriarchy to schooling and discipline. We're also going to be looking at what are the promising practices that we've seen or that we've participated that incorporate parents and containers of education or training through RJ practices, looking at what does RJ work attempt to do with parent communities, and how and why are parents important to the implementation of RJ. And so to get us started, Maida and I are going to be doing some exploration around our grandparents, our parents, and then the generation that we are in. So all of that, I'm going to pass the mic to Maida.
So a lot of the work that I'm able to do, that I'm very privileged to do and blessed to do within CCEJ, is I've been able to do work with parents and caregivers of adolescent youth, bringing trainings and bringing workshops on restorative practices and restorative justice, right, to support them in their movements, in their leadership, in their actions, right. Many of these parents have been civically engaged for a really long time, so it's such an honor to learn from them, right? And also working with a lot of our school partners that have been engaging with their parents and really putting a lot of effort to ensure that their restorative practices and their restorative justice works extends beyond the school and is really welcoming of parents and their leadership and their contributions into that culture, the culture shift that they're working to create in their school environments. And I just want to mention that I do ground myself a lot in the reflections of my own ancestors and my own lineage, right, and where I come from, and looking beyond my own schooling experiences and thinking about how that all connects with, you know, my parents' schooling experiences and the values that they live by, as well as my grandparents and the legacy that they left behind as well. And so with that, I would like to talk a little bit about them, right, and some of like their guides and how they identify and what was important to them and what they have kind of passed on to me that I've been really privileged and grateful to receive from them. And so I want to bring into the room my mother, Consuelo Serna, who recently passed recently transitioned, and a lot of when I think about schooling and my schooling experiences and who advocated for me and who, you know, was my guide in a lot of ways and teaching me, right? And thinking about educación, right? And how educación happens outside of school walls. And she was, to me, when I think of educación and my educación, I think about my mother, right? I think about the values that she taught me that continue to inform me, you know, and my work to this day and how I am in the world, really. And so Consuelo Serna is my mother, Consuelo Serna Arámbula, I should say, that was her first last name, Arámbula. And also my father, Consuelo Serna Esqueda, were such important teachers for me, right? And so my parents immigrated here from Aguascalientes, Mexico, and specifically a small town by the name of El Taray. Before them, my abuelos, Emilia Laris, Juan Arámbula, Crescenciano Serna, and Maria Esqueda are my maternal and paternal grandparents. Growing up, my parents recounted like a lot of experiences with their own parents, right? Growing up, tending to land. My grandparents were actually some of the first families that lived in the town that my parents grew up in, El Taray. So after the Mexican Revolution, some of the families that were previously campesinos that worked land for hacendados, fought for land, and they challenged the government to ensure that families could have their own land and that they could tend to their own food and their own livestock in order to sustain themselves and their families. And so my grandparents are part of those families. And so I know that growing up, I heard a lot of stories about that. And my parents always have so much pride for coming, you know, for being part of that, being part of those first families, you know, to be able to have access to land again and be able to access and cultivate their own food. And so I wanted to kind of highlight them and then talk a little bit about, you know, my mother and my father, who I had more access to learning from growing up, of course, and their stories, you know, navigating growing up and going through the school system where they're from in El Taray, Mexico. And so my parents have told me stories about how they actually... they were able to receive formal education up to the sixth grade. And during those schooling experiences, they have shared with me around like some really good experiences that they had with like making friends, of course, and, you know, learning so much while they were in school. However, also facing a lot of punitive disciplinary practices, right, when they were going through school, and a lot of kind of authoritative methods of discipline, right, that they had to face while in school, but also in their own communities, in their own homes, right? My parents, from a very young age, they knew how to grow food, they knew how to tend to their livestock, and many times carried a lot of that responsibility for their own families to ensure that everybody was fed, that everybody was cared for, you know, through harvesting a lot of that, a lot of their, through cultivating, you know, their land and harvesting their food, etc. And so I think for me, it's like there's so much to unpack there in terms of resilience practices, resiliency and resistance of my parents, and just the knowledge and the wisdom that they drew from learning how to make and how to do and how to sustain themselves, right, from a very young age. And then there's also some painful memories in terms of just the hardships that they experienced, you know, growing up in that way. And part of that being like a lot of, which we're going to be talking a lot about today, is punitive disciplinary practices that they had to endure, sometimes as a result of making mistakes, right? Making mistakes that would cost the family, you know, maybe not having enough food for the day, or maybe, you know, not producing in the way that was required to sustain everyone. And so I think about those stories, and I think about that background and that all those valuable like experiences and traditions, right? And how they have been able to carry that on as they've, you know, as they immigrated here to the United States, and how that carried over in terms of like witnessing as I was growing up, a lot of the legacy and like a lot of the carrying over of those traditions, right? can hear the elotero in the background. Just like lover street vendors and loving that, you know, I get to be part of a community. I hear them on a daily basis. And so the thing that I want to really bring it to is the way that all of this emerged growing up in Santa Ana, right, where my parents kind of brought all of that, all of those gifts and all of those experiences, and how that really informed my schooling experience and the way that my parents perceived the education system here, and how even though they had all this wealth of knowledge and information and ability to survive and sustain themselves, that that wasn't always acknowledged in the school setting where I grew up, where I was formally educated, right? That wasn't something that was really necessarily celebrated or acknowledged or talked about really or invited. And so I did kind of speaking very personally, right, from this very subjective experience, I also acknowledge that my parents sometimes felt like this kind of trust of schools in terms of, you know, they know how to educate our children, and sometimes feeling like they didn't always necessarily have like the skills or the resources in the home. I was witnessing and seeing all the knowledge and all the wisdom that they brought and that they were constantly utilizing, right, to care for us, to sustain us, me and my four other siblings, all five of us, right? While in the school, that wasn't always like acknowledged or celebrated, or there was really no space for that, right? And so I also saw how my parents oftentimes deferred to the school in terms of like providing all like formal education based on their own schooling experiences, having kind of internalized that, you know, all the knowledge that we really needed to quote unquote succeed, right, within the US system was all held within the school setting. There was like a deferring, right, to like teachers know what's best, school personnel know what's best, right, to educate us, to prepare us, right, to be able to survive within this, you know, within this U.S., you know, capitalist society, and to quote unquote make it, right. And so It's just been really interesting to unpack a lot of those experiences and to unlearn really a lot of the harm that institutions cause and the erasure, right, of the gifts and of the cultural wealth that really we brought that my parents brought over. I share that to kind of celebrate my parents and also to name and critique the ways that institutions didn't always support or like capitalize on those, the wisdom and the experiences that my parents brought, you know, here to the U.S. And, you know, into our communities.
Thanks, Maida. Much appreciation for that, and to all of your parents and to your grandparents. On my end, I'll start with the mother root. On my mom's side, my abuela, Emma Berumen Salcido, was born in a ranch in state of Durango. She was like one of 16 siblings, and I think she was like one of the more younger girls, if I remember correctly. She wanted to be a nurse. She wanted to go to school. From what I hear, the boys were able to go to some type of schooling. The girls were meant to be on the ranch. And, you know, I don't know how much schooling the boys were able to do as well, because it was like, you know, it was a huge ranch that they had to maintain. And so at one point, when she was older, she did run away and leave her home to be able to go to school, to be able to go to nursing school. I remember, I think as I was hearing you talking, I was thinking about my family. And I remember when I was like super little, there was this like thick book of diagrams of the human body with like the plastic sheets that were like, if you overlaid it, you could see like the different systems of organs, the different body systems onto like one body. And when my grandparents moved from the house that I grew up in, I think it was a Grey's Anatomy book, which I, you know, connected to the show. But then you saw, like, literally I grew up as a little boy always super fascinated by this book. And it was a book that my grandmother always, I think she always encouraged me to look at it. I always had doctor's kits growing up. I think for her fantasy, for me, her desire for me, she would always say that her dream for me was to roll up in a Mercedes and a white lab coat. Like, she wanted me to be a doctor. She would say that my hands were the hands of a doctor. And so growing up, that's what I heard. My abuelo, Adalberto Salcido, was born in Sonoita, Sonora, in Mexico, and he eventually became a construction worker, and they lived and worked in Tijuana. When they were in Tijuana, that's when he crossed over and crossed over to work in California. So he worked in onion fields and orange fields and strawberry fields all the way to Salinas, and then down and through Orange County, which I think is how he became familiar to Orange County. And my memories of him when I was younger, of him in the backyard, in the front yard. Recently, I was going for a run around like 6 o'clock. There's a smell of wet grass in the evening that reminds me of him, because he would go and he would water both yards. And to water, you know, the backyard had fruit trees. I grew up eating fruit from a tree, like aguacate, avocado, pomegranate, granada, like figs. You know, I grew up, there would be a basket of fruit that would be brought in from the backyard. And he would spend the weekends like taking care of the front yard, the backyard. My home place is that backyard. So my mom, Emma Salcido, she was born in Mexicali. And when she was in third grade is when my abuelo had saved up for all of their papers. And they immigrated to San Isidro, which is on the other side of the border. They lived in their first house in San Isidro. So my cousins called my mom Tia Mots, and my tios and tias, they did that because my uncles and aunts, their nickname for my mother is Mots, and each of them had their own nickname. And when we were old enough to ask, you know, to be critical or to be curious of like, wait, why do they call you Tia Mots? And so my mom told me that the first word that she liked to drink apple juice. And one of the first words she was able to say was Mots, for the Mots apple juice, that brand. And so that became her nickname from her siblings of Mots, because of the apple juice. And all of the other nicknames were in some way related to food or to an American product. And I thought that was so crazy that her nickname was, you know, based on like an American brand of apple juice. So the house that I would describe with the front yard and the backyard is the house that they eventually all grew up in, because eventually my abuelo was able to save up enough money to buy a home in Santa Ana. And so they all grew up in the house. They did not leave the house until they were married, which was 20, 21. And my mom, growing up, I used to watch the Brady Bunch, and my mom would say that the way in which they grew up or the way in which they went to school was super similar, and that, you know, even the way that the Brady Bunch kids dressed was similar to the ways that they wanted to dress or how they dressed. I think I always had an experience of my mom's stories about school as being very much like the cover of a Peachy folder, where there was a bunch of activities, there was a bunch of, like, they were all in band and music, they were in like a bunch of clubs, they spent time after school, in school, you know, I grew up knowing like every family on the block that my abuela's house was on. I grew up knowing the friends of all of my tios and tias, like I knew them, they knew me. So it was a very communal way of being and living in Santa Ana. And my mom liked school, and she wanted to be either a pilot or a flight attendant. But my abuela had told her that she had the choice of getting married or working. It was one or the other. And so I grew up knowing that story. And so for me, I grew up with being told by both of my parents that I had the choice to do what I wanted to do, to go to school or to work. All of my uncles and aunts, many of them work in the same jobs that they've had for years, like working for Ralph's or for like a produce company, and they worked in the same job like since I've been little. And my mom also encouraged me to go to school and to read. She always gave me books. And so on her side of the family, I'm the first generation born in this country, the oldest out of 16, 18 cousins. And so I retain a lot of the stories and the language from my abuelo. On my dad's side, my grandmother, Marta Atencio, was born in New Mexico. My grandfather was also, he was born in Chamba, New Mexico. His name was Fabian Salazar. He passed, it's been many years ago. And my dad was actually born in Laramie, Wyoming. And so they are old school Southwest, Colorado, New Mexico families. Both of my grandparents were like one of like 12, 16, like a number of siblings. And I grew up not knowing that much about them. My dad was, eventually they all moved to Westminster. They lived in Westminster Garden Grove. They had a pool. They had a big house. They had a big yard. The house was different than my grandmother's, than my abuela's house. They both houses that I grew up in of my grandparents were big, but there was something about my grandparents' house that maybe because of the pool, it just seemed like bigger or more like spacious. And my grandpa eventually, he was a mechanic, and then he eventually had his own business customizing cars. And so my dad also worked there. But my upbringing was that I had an abuelo and abuela and tios and tios, and I had a grandma and a grandpa and an uncle, my uncle Rick, and that I would speak Spanish with my mom and at my abuela's house, but I would speak English with my dad and at my grandparents' house. And so I heard my grandparents, my father's parents, speak in Spanish to each other, but it was only when it was to each other, and it was only when there was like a secret. Things like, what did you buy them for Christmas? And they would have the conversation. My mother would have to say, speak Spanish, like, they understand what you're saying. And so they did not speak Spanish to my uncle or to my dad. My uncle and my dad understand it, have always been around it, growing up in Westminster, but do never felt comfortable claiming fluency or speaking in it. So when I was born, my father very much wanted us to be bilingual, to speak Spanish. And so I have this like bilingual, bicultural, later on a very Spanglish upbringing. My grandmother worked for Kodak. And so she like worked for Kodak for a super long time. My grandfather had his business. He had a room that was just an office with his desk. He had a room in that office space was shelves and shelves of National Geographic. And I was able to like look at them, but I had to be very careful and I had to put it back exactly where it was. When I think critically about them and their upbringing, I can't help but be curious or wonder what the experience was like for my grandparents of why they did not speak Spanish to my father, to my uncle. What happened to them when they were younger, when they were in school perhaps? Like how were they disciplined for speaking Spanish? You know, there's also racism between on the part of my grandparents and my dad, on the part of my mom and her side of the family, being immigrants, being born in Mexico, my dad's side, being born in this country, but still also being Mexican. And and also like racism to not claim being Mexican too, and claim being Spanish. I went to native speaking Spanish class for freshman year of high school, and felt so, like, I had never read in Spanish before, and had the experience of even in elementary school when I was in Santana, being placed into ELD classes, and my mother having to go to school and saying, he speaks English, he's bilingual, he doesn't have to be in his classes. And then when I was in those classes, I would be tested in Spanish, and then I would feel bad if I didn't know a particular word for something because I only knew it in English. And I remember my mother, like, advocating for me not to be pulled out of class and be in ELD. And I remember me thinking like, oh, well, this is kind of cool. At the same time, like, why am I in this new class? You know, because bilingual education was not a thing back in the day in the 80s. And the last thing I'll say in terms of discipline, it was my father that did it, my dad that did the discipline. Like the dad, there wasn't a chancla, but there was the belt. When I started living with my partner and my partner would remove his belt, the way he would like remove his belt, it brought up this trauma of being little and seeing my dad take off his belt and about to be like smacked. And my relationship to him is not the same at all like my mom. Growing up, my abuela was very much, you know, a grandparent, but also like another parent, really. And so I've always felt very loving towards her and by her. And then when I was an adult, I learned from my mother that what her experience was with her, and she was the disciplinarian, in the family, and how their relationship was strained. I'm gonna pass the mic to you, Amanda, if you're ready to break it down about colonialization, what we can bring into this conversation.
So growing up, I didn't necessarily obviously as a young child, didn't make connections across, thinking about my education, my formal education experiences and my parents and how it all connects to colonial practices and colonization, as well as discipline, right? I think just to be fully transparent, in our home, unfortunately, we also had to deal with la chancla, right? And sometimes my parents were, at their capacity, sometimes due to a lot of stress, they would resort to disciplining us, through corporal punishment. And so my mom used the chancla with us. My father, kind of like you shared, Gilbert, would use the cinto with us. Oftentimes, my mother would pressure him to use it. And I could tell both of them that it would break their hearts to do that, right? And there was always a rupture and a loss of trust and from us and a deep fear. And there was also always an attempt from them to repair the rupture, always an attempt to say, they were truly sorry for doing that, for resorting to that, that they felt like they didn't have a choice in the moment. And there was always food involved for some reason in terms of mending that, and repairing that harm. And there was always a sense of peace after that, after folks were fed and taken care of. For me and my siblings, there was always some sense of peace with it and a ability to move forward from that, right? And so it's been really interesting, to talk to so many parents, to connect with so many parents. Before doing this work with CCJ, I worked at a preschool in Santana, which was a parent education program and a preschool program. And so for the 8 years that I was there as a program director, I just got a chance to learn so much from parents there, a lot of parent leaders and activists and a lot of immigrant folks, right? And so learning the way that they engaged, with their children, the way that they engaged discipline, right? Sometimes punitive, sometimes not. And some of the really deep conversations that we were able to have around what informed their parenting and why they felt like they resorted to that, and also other tools that they were kind of incorporating into their parenting that would allow them to move beyond La Chancla, move beyond those practices, right? And engage more dialogue, right? And centering and respecting their children as full human beings, worthy of respect, worthy of dignity, worthy of care, right? Worthy of being engaged and ask questions rather than resorting to those ways. And so I kind of draw from a lot of these experiences, and I've been able to kind of reflect on those and think about the role of colonization in that history. And so in my graduate studies, I was really invested in learning more about the history of education, specifically within the Southwest, and specifically education of Mexican, Mexican origin, Mexicano, children and Latinx youth, right? Growing up and moving through these institutions, and also the role of parents and all of that, right? And so I was able to learn so much about the history of colonization here in the U.S., right? I was able to learn about an active effort of removing people of color from governance, from administration, from creating content in the public education system. After the U.S. claimed, right, or stole the land of California, Colorado, what is Texas, what is now, considered the Southwest, right? And so thinking about how it came to be that white-centric curriculum, became the dominant, right, form of curriculum, English-only policies, became prevalent, right, and have continued to, since then, right, emerge. Assimilation practices, I think back to when I was being, quote-unquote, educated, right, through that system, how much symbolism and acts of like racist microaggressions, right? And ways in which like all of that colonial project was like still reinforced, right? And also like learning about like the substandard education that oftentimes was like imposed for Mexican and Latin American origin children, right? To maintain like a cheap labor source too, right? And so I think about all of that. And I think about also like the punitive practices within schools that have been used within schools to discipline, right? And to correct and to kind of ensure that there's a kind of like enforcing of like the capitalist, like patriarchal white supremacist structure, and to colonialism, showed up in the history of the education system within the Southwest, including like punitive practices, right? To control behavior, to ensure that legacy continue. And also on a separate note, thinking about discipline and punitive disciplinary practices that emerged like in my community and in my home, I also think back to my parents and how they were brought up, right? So I think about how when they were growing up in the rancho, like my dad has shared stories of, for instance, he shared the story with me the other day of a time when my grandfather had spent like the whole morning ordeñando las vacas. How do you say that in English? Milking the cows, right? Like he had spent the whole morning like milking the cows, and he had buckets full of milk, right? And he brought those into the house. And I guess one of the neighborhood like stray dogs came in and licked into one of the buckets, oh, right? Uh-huh. And my grandfather was so enraged in that moment. And my dad always talks about what a hot temper like my grandfather had, right? And just want to put like an activation warning for anyone who's like activated by like animal abuse and harm. And so my grandfather actually shot the dog out of frustration, out of anger, right? Out of like maybe a sense of scarcity, right? And so fortunately the dog survived. My dad was saying that they even gave the dog a nickname for being such a survivor. And so I think about that, and my dad shares a lot of stories of when my abuelito hit him because of his frustration, because my dad would go out to work with his brothers and sisters, to work the land. And sometimes if they fell short, if they didn't, quite produce the way that, my grandfather wanted to, like there was always like corporal punishment as a result of that. And so to think that before that, my grandparents, they worked land for other people, right? They worked land for hacendados, right? For folks that owned haciendas, where my grandparents had to work that land. I think about, some of their practices and some of the ways that maybe they had been punished, right? For not, producing the amounts that like the landowners wanted, right? And so I have a lot of curiosity and have engaged in a lot of conversations with like my own parents around like, where do those practices come from? Like, where does that punishment come from? Does it come from like a place of scarcity? Does it come from a place of like wanting to sustain? And then like in thinking about trauma and historical rooted trauma, right? And the way that colonization works around like, inflicting pain to a generation, having intimate relationships, exerting power through violence, right? Like symbolic or corporal or otherwise, and how that has carried forward in the, in the different generations, right? And how like my grandparents experienced like that violence growing up through their work that they were doing on other people's land, how they perpetuated a lot of those same practices of like correcting behavior, and how that carried forward, into, the next generation with my parents. And then how oftentimes my parents, due to stress, navigating in this country through, where they've had to navigate a lot of like racism and a lot of challenges, I think, due, like coming as undocumented folks, right? Not speaking English, not always having like the best opportunities for employment, right? Not always having, the means to sustain themselves and their families, and the stress that really causes, right? To be treated as second class citizens in this country, right? And how a lot of these like internalized practices are also kind of, I would say, like aggravated, right, by those conditions, by those inhumane conditions, right, that nobody should have to live through, and how oftentimes that also resorted to like perpetuating like the same power dynamics and the same power structures, right, that were inflicted on them, oftentimes like not having other ways to engage, right, and like also inflicted that harm on us. And what's really like interesting to think about is when I was younger, I remember engaging my mom in conversations around, you know, why she felt the need to hit us, right? Or why she would hit us, and why she didn't hit the other children that she babysat, the other children, other people's children, right? And I remember very clearly one time she said, well, I can hit you because you're mine, right? And I don't have time to sit there and talk to you and hear you out. But with them, I don't have a choice. And so I want to center my parents and their resilience and like their knowledge and their ability to like work through conflict and work through and respect children, right? And respect autonomy of children. Do an amazing job at raising children, theirs and other people's children, right? And oftentimes due to the inhumane conditions in which they had to kind of survive and sustain themselves, having to resort to those practices because of all like the pressure of those things, right? I think it all kind of like connects, and I'm able to kind of see the full humanity and the complexity of my parents and to still honor and respect them, right? And make sense of, or continue to make sense. And I think for the rest of my life, I will continue to make sense, right, of why and how, you know, they resorted to disciplining us due to a fear of us maybe, you know, I know they would say like, you know, we don't want you all to be spoiled. Like, we want you all to respect. We want you all to do well for yourselves. And so I think really being so nervous about, you know, how it is that they were going to set us up to do okay for ourselves within this system, right? This society that is like the U.S. and not always knowing how to engage that, and not always knowing like what is the best way to like educate us, you know. And now that my mom has passed, like looking back, you know, I have nothing but like gratitude and so much respect and admiration for her just doing her very best, you know, to raise us and to like educate us as best she could, given like all the constraints and all the limitations, right, that she had to navigate.
How has knowing your parents, your family's stories impacted you as an adult, or how has it impacted your viewing of them through more resiliency or empathy?
I think definitely, I'm grateful that my parents are storytellers. I'm grateful that when we all get together in family, especially usually when we're engaging our hands, when we're in the kitchen, when we're making food, I'm grateful that they are storytellers. They come from a tradition of storytellers that they oftentimes share things that I'm just like, just kind of open up the world for me and open up a window into their lives, into what informed their upbringing, right? Sometimes when we were little, we didn't have the same opportunities to share in story and to hear them out. I think they were so just busy all the time, just trying to raise us, just trying to make ends meet, right? Just surviving, that now as an adult, it's been really beautiful to sit down, to be together as adults, right? And to hear their stories. I also want to reflect on the fact that, like, you know, since my mother's passing, I've had a lot of opportunities to also hear a lot of stories from my tías and my tíos about her life, from my cousins, about her life, from other people that my mom raised, had a hand in raising, right, about their experiences with my mom and their stories. And so all of that has really helped me grow in my empathy, in my understanding, and also has allowed me to look at my dad differently as well, because I've seen the beautiful ways in which my dad has gone through his own healing process since my mom's passing, and his own growth, where now he's taking on practices that I've never seen him engage. You know, he's really into cooking now. He's really, and I think about like patriarchy, and I think about the role of all of that in shaping you know, where they felt like they could engage, where they felt like they could like exist, right? And like do and be, right, in the world. And so I think all of those recent kind of discoveries and then everything before that have really allowed me to grow in my empathy and my respect for them and in my kind of admiration of their resilience practices and how recognizing that like the conditions, right, that they have had to navigate, that they have had to endure, really shaped a lot of the ways that they felt like they could or couldn't express, right? Where they felt like they didn't always know, you know, what, if they would be doing more harm or good, you know, if they didn't discipline us in that way, if they didn't punish us harshly, you know, perhaps they would be doing us a disservice by not correcting our behavior, right? And so I think about that. And
I think that, you know, so, and I know that we've talked about this, Maida, before, of like the disservice very much could have been around survival and safety, that if this behavior is not corrected, then outside the house or the family or the community or the block or the rancho, like outside of that, within whatever power is holding power outside, then one's survival could very well be into question. So the reason why I asked the question to you about the resiliency and empathy in your parents' stories is because, you know, for so many people, there's such an unknown place about ancestry and about lineage and legacy. So much unknown because either the grandparents are alive in space and community, or have been killed or no longer there, or that if the grandparents are there, that because of trauma that they experience, that there is not the resiliency, or there is not the ability to actually narrate what had happened to them or what had been witnessed. And I say that because I don't know. I know much less about the grandparents on my grandparents on my dad's side, my dad's parents. I know more, or I know what I've been told from my abuelos, from my mother's side. There's also the question of I know what has been given or what has been, you know, what may have been edited at the same time. And so, you know, I have much more comfortability presenting Chicano identity. I have much less comfortability presenting an identity that I'm also an enrolled tribal member of the Anoatam Nation. And so because it was not, growing up, I did not know that my mother's grandfather, Miguel Salcido, was Mexican, but an enrolled member of the Taano people. And then, you know, just last Thanksgiving time, speaking to my abuelo and talking about his upbringing and his father, which he did not really grow up with, but also talking about the tribe and the people and the going back and forth. The border has been imposed through many tribal nations. And the, you know, what is now the U.S.-Mexican border was once just a homeland. So I think about that, and I think about stories that I was not told. And I go back to why my grandparents didn't speak Spanish to my uncle and to my dad. Like what went into the motivation of those choices. And I know you mentioned assimilation. So I just think about what one generation thinks is needed for their offspring to be able to survive and thrive and succeed. And so the choice making that they have to do for survival, and then the impacts of those choice making, the ways in which trauma has impacted that.
I think it's definitely like all about like trying to survive, trying to thrive, trying to like carry the family forward, right? And trying to like impose like values that they felt were so important to folks, you know, growing up and doing okay for themselves and like being able to navigate the world. And like, I think to this day, I mean, I hear my dad talk a lot about like those stories, right? And some of the pain that he still carries from some of the experiences and some of the conversations that he was never able to have with my grandfather, right? Around his own feelings and really growing in his ability to like name his emotion and name his needs. as he's gotten older has been really beautiful to witness, right? And like, I have to remind myself that he didn't always have those opportunities growing up because, you know, all the limited like constraints that he had to like be forced to live through, like when he was younger, always having to work.
We are going to end this first part of this two-part episode with this call to action, which is a series of questions for all of us to think about. What are stories of our family's upbringing, language, community, land, travel, forced or voluntary, that we know of? What are or what were the relationships that you have with your parents and your parents to their parents? How has knowing or not knowing these stories or relationships impacted you? Knowing that the act of knowing can be a privilege, that not all of us have grown in biological or created families where emotional, social, and physical needs were met. In part two of our conversation, we'll be bringing it back specifically to schools and discipline and what and how our work in RJ implementation is regarding working with schools and parents. Final question for us to think about as we move into our next episode of part two is, what have been your experiences with school and discipline? So a big invitation for us to consider any of these questions. Thank you for listening.